Hi there, I'm Dexter Fergie, and this is New Books in the History of the Social Sciences. Thanks for listening. Today I'll be speaking with Bill Rankin about his impressive new book called After the Map: Cartography, Navigation, and the Transformation of Territory in the 20th Century. It was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2016. Bill Rankin by day is an assistant professor of history at Yale. By night, he is an award-winning cartographer, and his cartographic expertise shines throughout the pages of After the Map. The book is a deep and rich exploration of the shift from maps to grids and eventually to GPS, or to use Bill's words, it is about the shift from paper to electronic signals, from the logic of representation to the logic of the grid, and from a focus on contiguous areas of space to a framework of points. The book traces 20th century developments in infrastructure, mapping techniques, and war that dramatically altered the meaning of territory. These developments produced novel geographic subjectivities, but also radically different conceptions of sovereignty and global politics. The book should interest historians of science and technology, Americanists, international historians, critical cartographers, and geographers. Today, Bill Rankin is on our show to discuss his new book, After the Map: Cartography, Navigation, and the Transformation of Territory in the 20th Century. Welcome to the New Books in the History of the Social Sciences, Bill.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Can you start us off by telling listeners a little bit about yourself, what brought you to history and specifically to writing this book?
Sure. So my background actually was in architecture and civil engineering. That's what I studied as an undergraduate. That's what I did for a few years after college. And then I kind of found my way to history of science through my interest in the kind of, you know, the technical aspects of making space, basically. So kind of coming out of my interests in space, my interests in design, finding my way into history of science, history of technology, kind of eventually led me towards mapping. And it wasn't initially that I was knew I was going to do the history of mapping. I actually first started out making maps just as a kind of diversion. And it was actually making maps myself that got me more interested in the history of mapping, and especially the kind of changes in mapping or alternatives to mapping in the last few decades.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. So there's a lot to discuss from your book. It's extremely rich. It's filled with so many different arguments. But before we get into the contents of the book, I just want to alert listeners to a couple of things. First, I want to note the book's inclusion of a surprising number of images. There's I think, over 140, which really helped me as a reader follow your arguments about changing mapping techniques. So kudos to your permissive editors at the University of Chicago Press. And second, all of those images, along with the bibliography, graphs, etc., are published in the book's beautiful supplementary website. So for listeners wanting visual references, I recommend checking out the website, and I'll link the site in the blog post. So to get started, the introduction neatly stakes out your goals, and you suggest that there are two scales to the book. The first, on the micro-political level, you are interested in the mapping sciences of the 20th century and how the development of new mapping techniques produced a new geographic subjectivity. And on the second, macro-political level, you are attempting to write a political and cultural history of geographic space itself. You connect both levels when you write that the 20th century change in the logic of mapping should be understood quite broadly as a shift in the nature of territory. So generally speaking, what were these changes to the logic of mapping and to the nature of territory?
Sure. I mean, and actually, I find similar changes at both scales. Which is about the shift from seeing the world as a collection of well-bounded areas. That's the kind of, you know, the familiar pastel shapes of the world map, the God's eye view from above, and going from that kind of area-based, well-bounded understanding of space to something which I call a more pointillistic space, where territory is managed and understood as a kind of constellation of disparate points, through everything from long-range bombing to kind of rapid response humanitarian aid, but also as an, at an individual level, understanding space not as your relationship to a well-bounded shape on a map, but understanding yourself as the kind of the dot in the middle of the map on your screen, or as the places that you know and travel to as dots somewhere else that you're connected through algorithms, navigation algorithms to get there. So both at the kind of big level of kind of grand strategy, military strategy, but not just military, but also at the sort of day-to-day level of how we actually understand ourselves and our surroundings, I see this kind of move towards the pointillistic, towards the kind of the individual point rather than the broad area.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So you divide the book into three parts, and each part you explore basically a different cartographic or navigation project. And the first one is the international map of the world and the logic of representation. So can you tell us a bit about the International Map of the World project, perhaps who were some of its proponents, what were their motivations, and what were some of the problems that they encountered?
Sure. The International Map of the World, like all three of the projects, in its time, it was proposed in 1891 and lasted for almost the entire 20th century, but especially in its heyday in the early 20th century, it was really an attempt to organize all geographic knowledge. The idea was that the countries of the world would collaborate on an atlas of unprecedented detail. A thousand or so map sheets, each with standardized graphics, allocation of responsibility divided by political authority, and then the resulting maps would be distributed through international channels. There was a kind of a central clearinghouse in England that coordinated everything. The idea was basically that geographers and mapping agencies should agree on some standards for their work, and therefore the world as a whole would be mapped in a way that could be legible to all. What's really interesting about the project, it started as really a project within geography. The original idea came from a German geographer named Albrecht Pengt. And his idea was really that, geography as a discipline needed a kind of core founding project. But by the eve of World War I, in order to make this project work, there was much more enrollment with national mapping agencies. So in order for it to get going, it moved from a kind of an academic project to a state-driven project. And that meant that allocation of responsibility for these various map sheets was divided by country. The kind of people who then kind of were the sort of second generation for running the project tended to be much more nationalist, much more interested in just sort of preserving their country's dignity, making sure that their country, had full mapping control over their own colonies, those kinds of things. So that was kind of one big shift from the kind of 1890s to World War I. A lot of that kind of mapping did happen in the 1920s and 30s. And then the other big shift was right after World War II, when the project was taken up by the UN, and instead of being a kind of nationalist project, started to be seen as a project of economic development, where the United Nations would help kind of train local mapping staff in colonies or former colonies in order to make sure that these new countries could kind of contribute to this large project, but especially to use mapping as a way to try to attract outside investment.
Okay, wonderful. And you touched on how there were these changes in notions of territory, but what about what you call geoepistemology? What was the geoepistemology of the International Map of the World?
Sure. Yeah. So I used the phrase geoepistemology basically as a way to say that it's not just what we know about the world that matters, but how we know it. Instead of trying to kind of tell the history of mapping as a history of, how accurate the knowledge is, how accurate the coastlines are, how many railroads and all that kind of stuff. What matters to me in the International Map of the World was how they organized their knowledge. And this was, in a kind of traditional cartographic way, this kind of view from above. But especially crucially here, there was really this very close allegiance to the apparatus of national governments, so that responsibility for each map sheet was divided based on, you know, which, you know, by country. So the kind of the project as a whole became a kind of, you know, kind of pixelated territorial game. This played out especially in Africa, where there was this big negotiation about which map sheets would be claimed by different colonial powers. Map sheets that were left unclaimed, for example, of Ethiopia, you know, Italy swooped in and said that it would map those. So it really seems that there was both visually and politically, there was this really strong allegiance to the national state as the kind of the basic organizing building block of the world.
Thank you. So in part two, cartographic grids and new territories of calculation, you move your focus away from this earlier International Map of the World project and think about grids and the creation of grids as an alternative to latitude and longitude. Can you explain the novelty of grids, why they were created, and what their original manifestations look like?
Sure. So a grid is, you know, basically exactly what it sounds like. It's really straightforward visually. Any topographic map that you might use for hiking probably has a grid on top of it, and that's what I'm referring to. But the trick about these grids is that they are measured in meters, sometimes yards, but usually meters, and they're totally flat. So they're not latitude and longitude, which are angular measurements, you know, anchored to the center of the Earth. They are Euclidean measurements, kind of running uniform across not just a single map sheet, but several, many map sheets. And so they first originated on the paper itself in World War One, and the idea was that you know, long-range guns were able to fire well out of sight of the gunner, and these map grids were really helpful for aiming those guns. So you could locate yourself on the grid, you and your gun on the grid, and you'd know your own coordinates, you'd get coordinates of a target, and you would very easily be able to calculate the distance and direction between you and your target in ways that are much easier to do than if you're using longitude and latitude. Now, what's interesting about those grids, though, is that they have a much longer history as a kind of, you know, scaffolding, a mathematical scaffolding for mapping, but they were never actually used for anything. They were never actually printed on maps until World War One, and at the same time during World War One, it's mostly done by the French. There's this big study of map projections to figure out what map projections can best do this trick of having a Euclidean grid on top of a curved Earth, and a total kind of, you know, transformation of how maps are printed and used. But one thing that's really fascinating, really right at the beginning, World War One, is that this new kind of coordinate system means that the map itself as a paper object kind of becomes obsolete. That once you have your own coordinates on this grid and you have your target's coordinates, you kind of don't need the map for much of anything. And so the grid is this really interesting and kind of crucial transformation in my story, where it's something that is absolutely coming out of mapping, cartography, paper maps. But once it's fully installed and realized and kind of literally installed on the battlefield, the maps themselves become the sigil, and what matters is your own point locations on this new kind of coordinate system.
Hmm. Thank you. Yeah, it's something that I had never really considered before, but I mean, grids are everywhere. We do live in gridded space. So in the second chapter of the part on grids, you discussed the universal transverse Mercator system. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how it reflects or reflected or perhaps even generated changes in notions of territory and globalism and sovereignty.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first grids, World War One, that was really confined just to the battlefields of the war, the Western Front, the Eastern Front. After World War One, especially during the 1930s, a lot of similar kind of small-scale grids were used for domestic purposes in a lot of different countries, not just France and Germany, but also the U.S., Egypt, Siam, lots of places. And then during World War II, these similar kind of patchwork of regional grids was used for artillery during the war, but it didn't really work. The British tried to cover kind of most of Eurasia with this kind of patchwork of custom-designed grids, each one trying to be sort of designed for a different theater of war. But the war was a war of motion rather than a static war of trench warfare. And so people were constantly, coming up against the boundaries of these coordinate systems, and having to fire across them was very difficult. And so the Americans, at first during the war, but especially after the war, the Universal Transverse Mercator was designed in 1947, 48, by the U.S. Army, really as a response to this kind of patchwork of individual grids, each of which was trying to be kind of custom fit to a particular country or a theater of war. And instead, the United States came up with a uniform series of 60 grid kind of strips, these very narrow grids going from the North Pole all the way to the South Pole, 60 right in a row, actually using the same kind of sheet logic as the international map of the world. And in so doing, this kind of very uniform global system, they also found mathematical tricks for making it easier to fire from one grid to the next. Basically, the sum result was that after World War II, this kind of point-based grid-like alternative to latitude and longitude became a global system that really was able to be used not just within particular areas, but really quite broadly. And as a new form of territory, I see this quite strongly as a way of really trying to make space kind of practically useful in ways that kind of transcended the boundaries of national states. So earlier maps and earlier grids, the kind of the knowledge space you were working in tended to stop at national boundaries. And the American system was explicitly designed to do away with that. So you could have kind of centimeter or even millimeter level precision cutting across national borders. And so that's really a crucial moment for me when you have this kind of transnational, but still very practical ability to work at space in this kind of smooth, borderless way.
Yeah, I agree. I think the differences are quite stark between earlier conceptions of space and the conceptions that the universe, that the grid provides. So as we move on to part three, titled Electronic Navigation and Territorial Pointillism, you take us down the road to GPS. And here we come into contact with some of the earlier predecessors of GPS, mainly radio navigation systems in the early 20th century. What are some of the differences between these early navigation systems and the grids or maps that you discussed in the previous chapters?
Sure. So I think that in many respects, GPS as we know it today works a lot like some of the grid systems I was just describing, which is to say what matters is your coordinate in a global system rather than your location within a bounded area. But what's really interesting about the history of radio navigation, which really starts in the 1910s, 1920s after World War I, there's a huge explosion of different kinds of systems in World War II, and then GPS is kind of created or starts to be created in the 1970s, and really doesn't become ubiquitous until the 1990s. So there's a very long history to these navigation technologies. And what's really interesting there is that this point-like, kind of grid-like way of organizing radio was not the only way, and for a long time was not the preferred way. In the early 20th century, in the 20s and 30s, especially in the United States, the main way that radio was used for navigation was creating kind of stable pathways. So the main technology in the United States was called the radio range, where you would fly from kind of airport to airport along very well-focused radio beams, and you would be able to sort of know whether you were on the beam or off the beam, and therefore be able to kind of hop your way from, across the country, just basically connecting dots along these kind of stable radio paths. And during World War II was really when you got this new way of using radio to create basically or literally grids rather than paths. Some of the first earliest radio navigation systems, there's one from Britain called GEE, for example, GEE, And that the G was also a code letter that stood for grid. The head of the radio, the radar project in Britain, Robert Watson Watt, famously said that his goal was to unfold an electronic grid over Germany. And the way that these systems work was that they had various kind of, you know, transponders placed here and there that would send out signals. But basically what you had in the cockpit was a map with lots of lines ruled over it and a black box that would give you two numbers. The black box was receiving signals from the ground, and the two numbers would correspond to some of the colored lines on your chart. And so just by locating yourselves at the intersection of two of these kind of kooky curved lines, you would be literally locating yourself in a radio grid. So it's not that there's a kind of... yes, there is a kind of similarity in how you experience these kinds of systems. They're grid-like in a kind of experiential sense. But the earliest ones in World War II were literally grids. There was actually lines printed on paper maps in exactly the same way that you have lines printed on the artillery maps of World War I. So to me, that's a really important way of anchoring the history of GPS, of radio navigation, into these same concerns about the role of maps, the increasing obsolescence of maps for navigation, the grid and the coordinate as being more important than the bounded area.
Wonderful. Thank you. So in the second part of part three, you begin to take us or explore GPS and its origins and its early history, and you really show how contingent it was. And it's kind of hard to imagine given how ubiquitous GPS is today. Can you sketch out this history for us? In particular, can you share with listeners what GPS, what global coverage actually means for geographic subjectivity and territoriality?
Yeah, sure. So on the first point, I think it's really important to kind of put yourself in the minds of a kind of mid-1960s radio engineer. There are literally dozens of navigation systems, and they kind of work well. And the engineers actually like the fact that there's so many, because that means that there's redundancy, there's backup, you can have a custom design system for helicopters, and a totally different kind of system for fishing vessels, and it's better than having just one system that does everything. And so it's really the Department of Defense, the U.S. Department of Defense, that says, no, we actually don't like how the Air Force and the Navy... and the Army, to a certain extent, all have their own systems, each confined to a specific use. And it's the Department of Defense trying to manage this huge military bureaucracy that comes up with the idea of trying to make one system that will displace all other systems. And so almost immediately, this is a project that nobody really wants, except this small group of people in the Department of Defense. So it's, you know, the accuracy that we now take for granted is obviously, you know, we want systems to be as accurate as possible. No one at the time actually needed kind of, you know, meter level precision in their navigation. Ships were totally fine with a couple of kilometers. Nobody needed global coverage, really. The U.S. Navy was one of the only agencies that did need it for guiding its nuclear submarines and ships. But they already had systems that did a very good job, and they didn't feel a need for anything new. All the other systems were, you know, tended to be local, or they would stretch across, say, the North Atlantic, connecting, you know, civil aviation between the U.S. and Europe, and they all basically worked fine. And so the story of GPS, it was approved in 1973, sort of through the 1970s, especially into the early 1980s. The story is really one of it being attacked from the people it was supposed to benefit. So the Navy was against it. The Air Force wanted to cut funding. The Department of Transportation had no interest in it. The FAA said it would never use it again and again and again. So it was really a system that really faced a lot of obstacles. One of the things that really kind of solidified it and made it actually happen was in 1983, there was an airliner that accidentally veered over Russian airspace on its way to Korea and was shot down by the Soviets, killing everyone on board, including a U.S. Congressman. And it was at that moment that President Reagan said, we're going to make GPS into a system that can be used for everyone, not just a military system. And it was really that kind of top-level engagement that, you know, kind of saved GPS from, budgetary neglect. But it also meant that GPS wasn't just going to be a military system for specialized, you know, smart bombs and things like that. So really, right from the beginning of its, even before it was really turned on, it's being kind of conceived of as a universal infrastructure, one that's going to be covering around the world at very high precision, used by the military and civilians alike, not just in the U.S., but in other countries as well. So that to me is, you know, a really important shift in terms of the kinds of infrastructures that organize space. And I think the key kind of experiential quality of GPS is that most people just experience it in a very local way. You know, for me, I get around my city, other cities I might travel to, but I don't really use it in a global way in any kind of meaningful sense. I'm not, you know, targeting missiles or going on big shipping expeditions. But everyone using GPS in their own local way everywhere around the world creates a kind of a global infrastructure of a kind of shared space without regional boundaries that's basically independent from the cookie cutter kind of jigsaw puzzle of national territory.
Thank you. So you conclude after the map with four really interesting sets of questions that your book provokes. Are there certain questions in particular that you would like to share with listeners?
Sure. So, I mean, there's four. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I think that the two that I think are, really kind of, I think, respond to the opening of the book with both the macro-political and the micro-political levels of analysis. One question is really, how does GPS change what it means to be a state? If there's a really, strong connection, and there is a strong connection historically, between national states and traditional cartography, if you look in the early modern period, for example, the creation of national mapping comes hand in hand with the creation of national borders and the sort of consequentiality of those borders. So if mapping and the national state are really closely linked historically, then what do we think about the fate of national states when geographic knowledge is no longer so tightly linked to the kind of, you know, political commitment over a defined area of space? And I don't know. I mean, that's a question that, is huge that I wouldn't be able to answer on my own. But I can imagine lots of ways that people could kind of ask that question in new ways, thinking about territory in a different way. So how would we think about what a state is if we no longer think of territory as a simple, well-bounded block of space? So that's one set of questions. And then the other, at the kind of the micro-political sense of everyday life and geographic subjectivity, I think one of the big questions is, GPS is a system created by the U.S. military for military purposes. It's mostly, you know, deployed and still used by huge organizations, not just the military, but, you know, commercial aviation, shipping, et cetera. And so it clearly gives those huge organizations, and the U.S. military in particular, much more kind of power, influence, et cetera. But it also gives a huge amount of new possibility to just everyday users. So you can, get around in places you have no familiarity with at all. You can go halfway around the world and find your way from A to B, no problem. You can find, new restaurants in faraway places, all that kind of stuff. But you can also use GPS, obviously for nefarious purposes. You can use it to make new maps from scratch in places where the state itself either can't or won't make maps. And so one of the questions is whether the kind of GPS acting as a force multiplier, that's the military's phrase, at the kind of large institutional level, is the benefit to those large institutions bigger proportionally then the benefit to these kind of small, local, everyday, unintended, perhaps even subversive uses. So is my capacity as an individual multiplied, you know, proportionally more, perhaps, than the military itself that it was originally designed to benefit? And this is really a question about kind of, you know, the intersection of geographic knowledge and power in a very straightforward sense, right? Does this give new forms of power, new possibilities to everyday users and unintended consequences, or does it only reinforce a kind of top-down vision coming from the U.S. military? And I think that's an open question. I think we need to have more kind of empirical studies at a local scale of how GPS is actually being used and how it's shifting kind of power dynamics on the ground. Is it opening up new possibilities for kind of bottom-up projects, or is it actually only giving the illusion of bottom-up agency, and actually what it's doing is consolidating power and influence only more in the hands of a few major actors?
Great, thank you. So there are two other broad questions that I wanted to ask you. So something that your book does really well is you show how globalism is always specific. It's not this like universal general thing. It's always specific, contingent, you know, representative of a particular set of people. And then you often will counterpose talk of globalism with talk of regionalism. So can you say something a little bit about how you use these terms and how what they mean to the three different projects that you looked at?
Sure, of course. So yeah, a lot of the kind of my reaction to kind of a lot of the work on globalization in general, really over the last several decades, is this weird oscillation between either things are national or they're global. And there seems to be a kind of a teleological sense of things starting national and ending up global, which doesn't really, I think, make sense historically. There have been kind of global systems literally for centuries. And as you just said, global isn't just one thing. There's lots of different ways of being global. And I'm interested in shifts in what it meant to be global rather than a kind of shift from national to global, which I don't think is really the right way to think about it. So, for example, just in the book, one of the obvious ones is that a kind of, you know, planetary scale knowledge as organized by, say, the international map of the world is really organized as a sort of state-to-state jigsaw puzzle, right? So this is really, you know, international in a certain sense rather than global, but it meant that the kind of the global system was kind of put together out of national building blocks. So the sort of the dichotomy in the early 20th century is between national and international, where international is what works at the planetary scale. And I think what distinguishes globalism or, you know, globality or whatever as the word picked up during and after World War II is instead of being paired with the national, it's paired with the regional. And I mean this in a somewhat specific sense. If you look at the way that maps were made, if you look at the way that, say, the universal transverse Mercator coordinates were used, if you look at the way that these navigation systems were designed and deployed during and after World War II, they're all operating at a regional rather than national scale. So they're explicitly designed to cross national borders, either extending national space into the oceans or extending national space over into other countries, such as the electronic grid unfolded over Germany. And to me, that's what really matters, is that the global, the kind of counterpart of the global is always the regional rather than the national. So I don't think that there's a kind of mega historical trajectory from national to global, but rather from a national-international duality to a regional-global duality. And you see that reflected, I mean, I haven't done the primary research on this, but just, you know, kind of impressionistically, you see this reflected in the way that, you know, regional blocs, trade groups, you know, security alliances, these are, the regional becomes a new kind of space of politics and economy in the post-war world very strongly. And one of the things that's so striking is that, you know, after World War II, especially in the 1960s and 70s, the kind of the breakup of all the European colonies, colonial empires, and then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the breakup of that empire, there's really a strong sense that, oh, the world is actually becoming more, you know, nationally organized. But that's happening on the backdrop of this very strong turn to this more regional organization of space. And to me, that's what I see in these mapping and navigation technologies, is a turn towards the regional rather than reinforcing this kind of the political ideal of a national state.
Absolutely. Thank you. And the sort of like a follow-up question to that. So your book is obviously, global in scope, but it is simultaneously a history of the rise of U.S. globalism, so a specific globalism. So I was wondering if you could just sketch out the connection between the shift in the nature of territory and U.S. hegemony.
Sure. So I think one of the things that I found again and again was that I can't write this story as just a story of the United States coming along and rebuilding the world in its image. So it doesn't start with projects in the United States that then get ramped up to global scale. It starts with projects in Europe. And the United States in the beginning of the story is not a minor player, but certainly not a major player. And what I find so interesting is that this is the story often about the United States kind of co-opting or scaling up technologies developed elsewhere. And what that means is that they're also technologies that, when they're scaled up, apply just as much to U.S. territory as they do to other territory. So the navigation systems or the grids in World War I or II, you scale those up to a global level, and the United States also becomes, a place that where borders are more permeable, and the sort of the horizon, the sort of subjectivity horizon, becomes more regional as well. And so this isn't I don't try to argue against the kind of rise of U.S. hegemony or global military power. These are, huge central themes in the book. But what I think I do try to say is that this isn't a project of the United States kind of trying to rule the rest of the world from on high, from its own kind of national fortress. This is about the U.S. Pursuing and creating a new kind of space that transforms the United States' power and territory just as much as it does other people's territory and potential. So that's, I really see it as kind of a new spatial, new rules of the game in terms of space and territory, rather than a story about the United States kind of dominating others underneath its, boot.
Absolutely, yeah. Just to conclude the interview, can you tell listeners what you are working on at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So I'm working on two books right now. One is a book about mapping based on my own mapping work. So like I said, I kind of got into the history of mapping first by making maps of my own. And I've been making maps for 10 or 15 years now. They're all on my I have a website about mapping called radicalcartography.net. And I'm bringing all those projects together into a kind of methodological book about mapping in the spatial humanities and spatial history, trying to figure out, how do we understand, kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of visually argumentative mapping in a data-saturated era? So it's kind of my response or my intervention into both, kind of narrow academic things like digital humanities or spatial history, but also more broadly into, what is mapping now that we're awash in data and maps are actually kind of more ubiquitous than ever before, but don't have the same kind of institutional authority that they once did. So we're no longer in a world where the maps come from, say, Rand McNally and National Geographic. Maps are created by everyday people, they're all over the web. What do we make of that, and what should we do? So that's one project. And the other is what I'm calling a spatial history of the environmental sciences in the last 50 years, trying to understand in ways that are slightly similar to the first book, but really focus more on environmental issues. How has the environment been made visible and legible? And this is not just about mapping. It's also about types of photography, aerial surveillance, certain kinds of mathematical modeling, spatial modeling, really trying to understand all the ways that the environment has been understood, and especially how there's been a huge change in how the environment has been visualized, say, from the beginning of the environmental movement in 1960 to the present.
Fascinating. I look forward to reading them. Well, thank you so much for your time, Bill, and I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks for having me.